staff ecologist for King County. He's been with King County almost 20 years. Before working for King County, he worked for the Tulalip Tribe in the U.S. Forest Service and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. He received his master's degree in fisheries and practices from Virginia Polytechnic Institute, and he received his bachelor's degree cum laude in Fair Fishery Sciences at UW. He's had numerous achievements, including he was a lead scientist for King County's Critical Area Ordinance, the best available science. He was involved with the Tri-County Salmon Recovery Initiative and two major King County Basin plans from the county's recent shoreline master plan update. Today's presentation is going to be wonderful. I'm looking forward to this. It's got three hot topics. Monitoring is a really important, big issue. Critical area ordinances, which are really a great tool here in the county. And are regulations effective? How do you evaluate whether something is working, or how do you evaluate effectiveness? So let's offer an enthusiastic welcome to Mr. Gino Luquet.
Well, thank you very much.
Is that too loud?
It is.
Yes, it is.
Blow your eardrums out. So I'm going to talk to you a little bit about a program that we're just starting to get going at King County. It's something that people have been wanting for a long time, which is basically to have a program to see whether or not what we're doing, particularly with respect to our regulations, is actually working. Wouldn't that be nice, since we have all these regulations, and one of the key questions is, do they work? Before we jump into the kind of the meat of the subject, I want to just kind of overview a little bit about monitoring in general. That, you know, what is monitoring? Phil Roney has a nice little statement. It's, you know, the systematic process of checking and looking for things, trying to detect change in the physical, chemical, or biological parameters of a system. There's a variety of types of monitoring: baseline, status, trend. And three other types. These are more the types that we're going to be doing, more of the implementation and compliance. Interestingly, with all these regulations, we have very little knowledge of how well they actually are followed and complied with. And a lot of the studies that have gone back and looked at change usually are retrospective studies that we don't really have a sense of how the regulations or what are the action is actually played out. The other thing that we'll be looking at especially is effectiveness. And I'll define what we mean by effectiveness a little bit later on. But ultimately, is what we're doing working? Is it preventing an impact, or is it causing the kind of impact that we want, a desirable? And then we hope to also address some of the validation of our assumptions. So we assume if we assume a certain amount of science based logic in this process. And I'll talk a little bit about our critical areas ordinance, and science played a very big role of that. But what's interesting is we're always dealing with assumptions. We're thinking that if we have buffers of a certain size, we're going to get a certain value. If we retain certain conditions of the landscape, we're going to have a certain value to that. But we don't really have much validation for how well that plays out. Why monitor? It's probably pretty obvious, because you want to see how things change, but ultimately monitoring is the thing that helps us reconcile what we want to believe is true with what is actually true. There's a great quote by Sir Francis Bacon that I like: people prefer to believe what they prefer to be true. So monitoring is the antithesis of that. It's like, let's not prefer it to be true. Let's really track it. Also, monitoring helps us to understand the risk of our actions. We never know anything with great certainty in science, and so things are usually cast more as a risk, a premise of risk, that if we do this, it has a certain likelihood of producing a result. And more we see risk can be presented as dollars or fish. Fish are a very major part of the reason we do things, so fish are a part of that risk equation. So the rest of the presentation, what I'd like to do is talk about the critical areas ordinance, a little bit about the background and what it's meant to do, and then why are we going to conduct a monitoring study for it, the study design that we are framing right now and will hopefully start up in August with actual field work, and then some of the expectations and the outputs and outcomes. So a little bit of perspective here. King County is, you know, of course, the most populous county in the state. Has, I think, about 2 million people in it now, give or take 100,000 or so. I think people tend to think King County is being so urbanized that everything is just so radically changed. But really, you can look at the county as broken up, or at least I look at the county as being broken up into thirds. The western third of the county, right along the shoreline, is heavily urbanized. It actually is legally defined as urban environment. Over here, these are the hinterlands, the places that I like to hike and go fishing sometimes. Probably some of you do too. These are the foothills and all the way up to the Cascade Crest. And these areas are not urbanized. They are range from pristine to maybe having a legacy of intense logging. We have a couple municipal watersheds. Here's the Cedar River watershed, and down here is the Upper Green River watershed. And we have wilderness areas. And then we have this area in between the urban and the forest and wilderness areas. And this is the area where a lot of the activity for the future rural growth is going to happen. And this is also the area that a lot of the study is going to be focusing on, because this is the area that still has potential for change from kind of a forested landscape to a more developed rural landscape. We also have Vashon Island, which is also all rural. And that will be a part of, probably a part of the study as well. And another way of seeing this red line is the urban growth area. This green line over here is the forest production zone. If you can keep those in mind, those are critical lines to remember. So again, King County has, as part of its environment, the most urbanized parts of the state. Here's the waterfront in Seattle. Here's the lower Cedar River, a nice, well-behaved, straight channel that's causing nothing but problems for the city of Renton because it was never designed properly. This used to be a big swamp. Lake Washington used to be 9 feet deeper until the ship canal was built in the early 1900s. So radical changes. But we still have a lot of places that don't look at all like that. We have shorelines. Some of these shorelines in this particular drift cell area of shoreline is in still very good shape. This is the Cedar River up by Landsberg. You know, you float down by that, and even though it is modified in many ways, it's still got a lot of stuff going on for it. It's still a very nice, beautiful area. So our regulations still have something to do in terms of protecting that in the future. A lot of our work is geared towards protecting our salmon species. They're obviously a very economically valuable species. They're an iconic kind of species for the Northwest. And King County, despite all of the land use, historically still has a lot of salmonid populations here in all our river systems. And even our urban streams. I know being part of some of the early work on urbanization and the effects of urbanization, there was a tendency to sometimes say we have no fish in our urban streams. We have lots of fish. They tend to be cutthroat trout. They don't have the diversity. It's not the fish species we want. So even in some of our heavily modified ones, we at least have some species of cutthroat trout. I grew up on the East Coast, and I like to jokingly say that back there when a stream degraded, it turned into a carp stream or a minnow stream or something like that. Here, at least, when they degrade, they turn into a cutthroat trout stream. But we have a lot of other things that we're required to do, and it's not just about salmon. In the early 1990s, Washington State passed something called the Growth Management Act. And you can read a lot more about it on the Puget Sound Partnership website and some other places if you want to hear more about it. But ostensibly, the act was trying to envision the fact that there's a lot of growth happening. They probably didn't envision how much growth was happening at the time. One of the good things it did is it really tried to control the growth by keeping it corralled in these urban growth areas that I pointed out in that red line in King County. Probably one of the things that it didn't quite do so well is it didn't anticipate the kind of things that go on outside the urban growth area. The rural development, which granted it's not as high intensity, not as impacting as urban development, but it still has its own suite of effects, including clearing off the land, a lot of the land of the forest cover, and replacing it with developed covers. But as a part of this, the Growth Management Act required that we protect the functions and values of critical areas, that we give special consideration to the anadromous fisheries that we have. This language has turned out to be very valuable for us. It also requires that agencies have substantive use of the best available science. It doesn't mean the BAS trumps some other policy concern, because ultimately the GMA is about a balancing act between protecting the environment and also facilitating the growth and economic engine that's out there. But it's interesting that it did say that when you are in doubt, you should be precautionary in favor of the resource. And also specifically points out that you can deviate from the best available science, but you have to give a rationale. So basically, for those of us who've been in government for a while, you know, you can't really control the vagaries of the elected officials and what they want to do. That's why we elect them, is to make those hard decisions. But neither can they just summarily say, well, we're just going to pick this number because that's what we want. They have to have a rationale for it to kind of help balance out the rationale that you might get from science in terms of what the logical things to do are. So we went through a process at King County, and you can go online and see it, and virtually every government doing planning under the Growth Management Act had to do this, of stating what we felt our best available science is. So again, you can go onto King County's website, and it wouldn't take too long to search it and pull up those documents. But we went through the whole rationale of what is it that controls our critical areas, particularly our habitats, what is it that makes them valuable, and how do we go about protecting them. And then we also did kind of a qualitative risk assessment of the ultimate regulations that came out of the process. It's helpful to think a little bit about what are critical areas. They aren't just fish habitat. They're a mix of what I would call environmental, fish and wildlife-oriented things, and a mix of what I would call mostly people-oriented things. And in my position, a lot of the equation is, you know, kind of balancing people with the fish and wildlife goals. Now, that's a very crude way of saying it, because a lot of times what we do, the right thing for one thing is also the right thing for the other. So we kind of point out that if you're doing it for fish or for the environment or for some other cause, it's generally also promoting a very good thing for people. But just from the kind of the rough balancing standpoint, it often comes down to that. So we have aquatic areas, streams, rivers, lakes, ponds, estuaries. We have wetlands. We have things called wildlife habitat conservation areas. We also have these hazard areas, and it's amazing. We have flood, erosion, seismic. Somebody thinks about the fact that we could have volcanoes here. And 20 years ago when I started up with King County, I never realized how much coal mining took place in this area. But there are places that are coal mine hazards, where they hope kids don't fall down coal mine shafts. And we also have aquifer recharge areas covering various parts of the county. I don't know if anybody here lives on Vashon Island. Anybody a Vashonite? I see some that could be. Vashon, a large part of it, they don't have an alternate water source. They don't have a big reservoir in some mountain area. Their island is their reservoir. And so they have to manage their land in a way that protects their water resource. Ultimately, as I said, this is kind of a balancing act. One of the things when you're in this field is the issue of property rights. It's not very well defined exactly where that bar is in terms of a taking of somebody's property right, but it's out there somewhere. Our critical areas ordinance is still going through a legal process of appeals. It's, I think, withstood three so far. I think they got one more. But, you know, the basic issue for this particular set of critical areas ordinance that we have for King County is whether or not our clearing limits is a taking. Or some form of an undue process. I can't quite remember how they do it, but it's like, I think the argument is that a kind of an indirect form of taxation, taking somebody's property away for some greater public good without compensation. Now, there's some level of that that's allowed. I'm not that is done and that is recognized by law. But that's one of the issues we have to deal with. We also have issues of urban and rural equity, and also goals in the urban environment and goals in the rural environment, as we describe here. So regulations are just one thing that we do. As we were developing the critical areas ordinance, it became obvious that we were lucky at King County, at least, and I think other counties do this too to a certain extent, in that we don't rely just on regulations to provide our protections and to provide the long-term health of our environment. We have a very active program of restoring impacted areas. We have a lot of flood control projects that de facto, if we manage them better, are actually also serving as habitat. And starting this year, we're just starting a 10-year program. I think it's going to cost about 30 to 35 million bucks a year, but they're going to be retrofitting a lot of our river systems and our flood control facilities. In many cases, what that means is moving the levees and revetments back or taking them out and the houses and structures entirely. In some cases where there's a lot of development that's there and we don't necessarily want to take what's out behind those levees, we set the levees back, create more of a cross-sectional area, which reduces some of the flooding concerns in the context of the cross-sectional area. And we typically will leave these revetments in a much better shape than the kind of the rock and invasive species dominated, you know, blackberry dominated kind of cover. We try to put woody debris in there and vegetation. So that's a major program for protection in the context of we're building a healthier environment. We have a major program of habitat and open space acquisitions at the county. We have educational and stewardship programs, a variety of county practices and incentives to keep people from doing less damaging things. And ultimately, we have a very active agricultural and forestry-related program. So all of those things go into the critical areas ordinance. Now, the other thing is the CAO, as I'll probably call it more than just saying the critical areas ordinance, is really a suite of things across three different major ordinances. The clearing and grading one is what defines the degree of clearing that and amount of land movement that people can do. The zoning code helps define the buffer sizes, and the stormwater defines how we manage the runoff. Those things all work together to create something that will ultimately help to protect our critical areas ordinance. When we did our best available science, one of the things that we concluded is buffers aren't just your basic stream site buffers aren't enough. Reliance on them is, while it's important, is probably not sufficient to really protect our critical areas. You also have to look at the larger landscape, and that's where our clearing goals came up. The other thing is that we really don't know how well, other than we know that they clearly didn't work because we could see that things changed in areas that were impacted by past development, we really don't ultimately know just how effective they were. And one of the big debates in passing our critical areas ordinance a couple years ago was, how can you adopt new ordinances when you don't know how well the old ones were working? Not a bad question, except when we go through the synthesis of our science, we suspect that even the old ordinance, which was called the sensitive areas ordinance, was probably not sufficient because it didn't require these landscape level controls. It also didn't probably allow for large enough buffers, streamside areas, to provide for all the processes that happen in the riparian system. And it also didn't account for all the variation in biological condition throughout the county. Some places may require more, and some places require less protections. So ultimately, just to kind of summarize, our CAO really has a variety of elements. It's really a comprehensive strategy. It's not just bigger buffers. It's regulations, it's restoration, stewardship, protection, education. I'm not going to go into too much detail. You can read about some of this, but our critical areas now have a new sets of definitions, hopefully better definitions and clearer definitions. Critical areas, what we call alteration tables, and also it has much more prescriptive outlines of things that are allowed. One of the criticisms of regulations is the amount of variances that have been allowed in the past. Now, variances are those things that come up when the regulations don't deal with a unique situation. Oftentimes, the decision was left up to a department director or somebody to say, well, we'll let this happen here. Our current set of regulations have a lot more description of what's allowed, when and where, and why. So it really reduces that amount of discretionary activity. And hopefully takes away some of that uncertainty that we get with regulations. We have a new system for buffers and classifying systems. We have a requirement that you have to designate your critical areas before you start putting in your septic systems and wells and before you start setting everything up. Major changes, well, we have generally, but not always, but generally larger buffers. They used to be 100 feet around fish-bearing size systems. Now they are 165 feet, and they're also variable in width. They start out by where the edge of the, they take into account the associated wetlands and steep slopes, and also the forest or the severe channel migration zones. We have clearing limits and seasonal restrictions, enhanced stormwater requirements, more mitigation. We have a series of prescriptions and stewardship activities, and CARAs are critical area recharge areas. We have limits on certain uses, and you can see that there. So, again, if you remember, I said we had this new set of regulations. It passed in 2005. A huge amount of debate was, why do you need these? You don't even know if the old ones are working. So one of our goals is to not be caught in that, to actually have a proactive program to see what is working and what isn't, and if we can even tell it. We want to better understand not just what's working or not, but also what's the role of scale and location of our activities and timing of activities and the behavior of our implementation. How do these things really play out on the land? Ultimately, we have a 2012, this is kind of a near-term goal, but a 2012 review of our comprehensive plan, which is a plan for the counties that kind of guide a lot of their land use policies. That's one of the near-term goals, that 2012 GMA-required review. But we also want to have a framework so that we can start assessing over the long term what's working. So I'll talk a little bit more about that later. So we want a long-term framework as well. Just kind of a general overview. I suspect many of you see this kind of a diagram in your classes on whether it be geology or ecology. But, of course, our landscape has a series of controls, geology, the climate, vegetation. Those controls tend to regulate the processes that drive the flow and storage and transport of nutrients, organic matter, water, sediment. Those processes are modified by what we do on the land and also the extent to which we protect and restore them. And ultimately wind up at some point, any given time, with a set of conditions on how much modified land cover there is and also how fragmented the land is. And ultimately, if it's not working, we would expect to see things like flashier flows, degraded water quality, lower biological richness and productivity, more pollution tolerant and edge adapted species. So from the top down, as our actions work on the system, if they're not working, we see that we should see changes in some of the basic processes. So again, some of the questions we want to know: did critical areas change? And can we really document that change relative to the CIO implementation? I think you'll see here in a little bit, we're going to try to study these in a way that if we do see change, we ought to be able to document where that change really started from. And is it from our actions? Is it from something that's beyond our actions? In a lot of these rural areas, the county doesn't control all of the actions. The state may control it with their forest practices permits, and also issuing hydraulic project approvals, which are what the state issues. So it's not just what the county regulates that can potentially cause change. We want to know whether or not that change, if we see it, was a result of some problem in implementation. Ultimately, we want to see, did the environment respond, and if so, how? And if it responds, what would we do differently? And again, this is the near-term goal for the GMA in 2012. So the study that we're developing has a basic purpose of providing some information on implementation and effectiveness by this 2012 review and also beyond. Basic goals are to track the changes in critical areas and also to determine the extent to which those changes are related to the CAO. So let's kind of go back to what if we followed that, what our objectives would be. We start out with a premise of we have a certain environmental context, we have a societal context. Those come together to create a best available science. And notice that, at least for us, people are part of the science. If you go through the science literature, there's nothing in the science literature that says protect everything all the time. It says take into account the realities of the social and economic situation when you're developing a strategy for protecting your resources. So pre-existing BAS went into creating a CAO. In the context of this, we're going to track our permits. We're going to assess the compliance of those permits. We're going to assess our subwater conditions, track the land cover changes, look at the response, monitor the magnitude and direction of the response. That feeds into hopefully a new and improved best available science. We ultimately feed that back into the policy and decision-making process and hopefully form a new CAO. So that's the general flow of how this project will go. We'll collect this information, how things work, what the response is. Our two guiding hypotheses are pretty straightforward. If the CAO works, then the direction and magnitude of response variables should be similar for areas with little or no additional future development. In other words, if the CAO is working, we shouldn't be able to detect any more change there than in a change where there's very little development going on. And also, we're going to kind of use a second standard. We're going to evaluate the potential cumulative effects of all of the actions that we have, run that through kind of a cumulative effects model and say, okay, given how much change is here, did we see a commensurate change in the response variables? So we'll really be using two kind of perspectives in order to try to evaluate change. The study design that we're going to use is something we call a natural or quasi-experiment. And by that, I mean we can't really control everything here, obviously, as will become obvious, I think, a little bit. But we can try to set things up and then let the process play out and see what happens. So ultimately, these treatments were not randomly selected. They are very much directed at trying to find places that we expect to see lots of change and then seeing if we can track and detect change. We have a certain watershed scale response that we're trying to get. So one of the things when you set up these studies is you could go out and look at every parcel and measure the effects at a parcel scale, but those may or may not add up to an effect at a larger catchment scale and watershed scale. So we want this to be more of a watershed scale response system. We want to choose relatively low order streams, and by that I mean generally second order, maybe a large first order or a small third order, but nothing that's too large in terms of its size and not so small that you're just picking up the idiosyncratic development of a particular parcel. And ultimately, in doing this, and I'll run through some stuff with you, we think we can identify 6 developing watersheds and 3 reference watersheds. I do want to point out, we use the word reference instead of control for the purpose of the fact that where we're going to wind up using places, we can't necessarily control all the development. So for instance, our reference systems may be places that logging goes on, very, very low-level development goes on. And part of that is because there is a lot of dispersed development almost everywhere, so it's really hard to find the quintessential undeveloped watershed. The drivers for this study will be the permits, the compliance, also enforcement, by the way, and the amount of land cover change. As I mentioned before, we're going to look at the potential effect of those drivers, of all the actions that we permit and other enforcement actions that we see. So we're going to actually develop a model. I don't know if any of you have ever taken Bob Wismar's class, but one of his graduate students, Ray Tim, developed a model with Bob where we're going to look at we're going to break our watersheds up into grid cells. We're going to track the change in condition of those grid cells, track the activities of those grid cells, and in terms of the actual things we do, we're going to rate each activity according to the intensity of the action, the area of the action, the sensitivity of the site and of the critical area and its proximity. Again, we hope this will mostly be automated and reduce the amount of filing through everybody's permits. But ultimately, it's the first time this has been done, so we can actually track over time what we think our effects potentially could be. So how about response? Let's see. I suspect that most people here are pretty familiar with land use change and the kinds of environmental responses, right? Is anybody here, who's taken a class on that? You know some of the basic effects of land uses. So what do we see? We see typically changes in flows. With King County, you'll see a paper coming out fairly soon. Some of my colleagues have been looking at our databases on flows and trying to figure out what is it about flow that we can really detect as a change. And it looks like the main part of the flow regime that we're most interested in, because it looks to be a good indicator of change, is during the summer base flows, when everything drops down to a standard flow path, the flashiness of those flows, in other words, how quickly it responds to precipitation events, seems to be a good indicator. Logically, because you change the forest and the soils, you put in imperviousness, all that short circuits the natural system and gets into the stream faster. We see changes with respect to the benthic organisms in the stream, so that's the BIBI, the benthic index of biotic integrity. That's our biological indicator. Water quality obviously can change a lot as we modify the land. In this particular case, we're going to focus mostly on conductivity as opposed to a lot of other variables. And again, this is partly because conductivity is very cheap to collect, easy to collect. That's an important thing, cheap and easy. But it also seems to be just as good an indicator as other measures of changes in basic water quality when we look at our data. And then stream complexity. One of the things that we think we see when we see land development happen is stream channels become simpler, less hydraulically diverse, less hydraulically complex. We lose pool environments, we lose woody debris, et cetera, et cetera. So we have a specific part of the study where we're going to use dye tracers, and we're going to run dye tracers through stream channels, and we're going to track the time of travel of those dye tracers, and also there are equations that allow us to calculate transient storage, which essentially is the amount of volume of water in a channel at any given time, and use those as surrogates for habitat complexity. The nice thing with those, as opposed to physically doing channel surveys, is the surveys, when they're done by people, tend to have biases. They tend to not be very repeatable. And they're also expensive, and they require us getting permission to travel on people's private property. If we could run these dye tracers through stream channels, we think we can get something that is repeatable, is unbiased, but doesn't require getting permissions. And again, it's a lot less expensive. Yes?
Could you explain, I don't really understand how a dye tracer can reflect on stream complexity. How do you interpret the results?
Right. Well, imagine, if you will, that you put in a slug of dye at one spot and you measure it down here, right? Okay. Down at some point downstream. You can look at the time of travel, you get a curve of concentration over time, right? The flashiness, or the degree to which that dye, the speed at which it passes through a reach, is an indication of how complex or uncomplex the channel is, the pathway of that channel. So if the channel is getting more complex, we would expect to see the travel times to be longer, the peak travel times, and the decay curve to be much more elongated out on that far end of the curve. So that's one way. So if we see travel times increase, if we see transient storage volumes increase, that's an indication to us that probably the habitat is getting basically more pools, more roughness, and which essentially are a lot of the same things we look for in stream surveys to measure habitat quality. That make sense? So we needed to set this whole thing up once we had this framework. One of the things we did, and you can again go into the King County website, but we've rated 556 or thereabouts catchments in King County for their condition. Not surprisingly, but the lowest rating, the ones in red, are the most urbanized. These are kind of what we would call medium rating, and all the green ones are what we would call in the higher condition. Now, we use this score to help us guide some of our more flexible components of our critical areas ordinance, but we can also use this to help guide the design of this study. Obviously, we're not terribly concerned over here because this is already developed, and it was developed under an old set of regulations. The areas over here start helping us define, and also here in Vashon, what catchments are potential candidates for study in the future. Then we kind of drilled down, and what we did was we looked at all the parcels in King County, and if you see these purplish splotches here, those are parcels where the improvements to value are generally 20%, the value of the improvements to the total land value are 20% or less, meaning there's relatively little on that parcel. There could either be no house on it or no structures, or perhaps a small structure or an old structure. But that tells us where the parcels are that are likely going to develop into the future under the new critical areas ordinance. And we were able to go back to the early or the late 1980s to look at all our permit information to help identify this. The other thing we needed to do is we needed to not include catchments that had other jurisdictions. So here's that urban growth boundary line that I pointed out to you before. Over here's the forest production boundary. And here's this is over in the Snoqualmie Valley. This is just one small part of King County. Here we have the city of Duval. Let's see, this is Redmond Ridge, this is Carnation. So, and then when we start looking at our catchments that we broke out, and these are mostly the catchments that we thought had good potential, we can start sorting out those that don't have a lot of overlap with these city environments and or with the other urban growth environments. And we can start looking in and saying, okay, it looks like we have places, catchments, with a lot of development potential. So all these gray splotches here are places that are undeveloped waiting to happen. We also tried to look for paired combinations to help strengthen the statistical procedure. We didn't have much success at that. King County has a major program of sampling already in place. Those sampling points aren't necessarily where we wish they would always be for this particular study, but just so in case you're curious, we do have this information. Perhaps some of you are working on studies that would benefit from this, but we also wanted to take advantage of those pre-existing gauging stations and monitoring stations where we had them. And ultimately, we have winnowed everything down to a series of potential candidates. We will be making the final selection in July of 6 treatment and 3 reference candidates. But for example, these ones highlighted in kind of this neon green are potential reference stations. This is Stossel Creek. This is the forest production boundary. And we think that the upper part of this, which again is subject to some activity but not intense rural land development, this is the city of Redmond's watershed. They actually have 2 little creeks that flow out of it. No development there. That's a good idea for a reference system. And then it looks like, in terms of our treatment systems, We have a cluster of small catchments right up in here in the Snoqualmie foothills, if you will. Also on Vashon, we have a cluster of potential catchments that look like they're good candidates. Maybe some down here in South Sound, but here's a problem with South Sound. I'm sure most of you know about the geologic history of the Puget Sound. This is a lot of what we would call glacial outwash plain. And so these are till-based systems here for the most part, but down in here there's a lot of deposits of glacial outwash, which is another confounding factor. So we're trying to find catchments that are as similar as possible, geologically speaking. Outputs of this, we will ultimately get information regarding the implementation. Let's go back, actually, if I could, back up to here. We got a little bit of time just to explain it. So just to kind of go back a little bit, when we pick one of these catchments, we will gauge, put in a flow gauge, put in water quality monitors. We will collect bug samples at the outlets of these catchments, and we'll also track all of the activity that we can that goes on in here. We are currently taking every other year very high quality aerial photographs so we can track what actually is changing. Those will get digitized, we'll get classified land covers. So we'll be able to track the activity, how that activity translates to change of the land cover, and then we'll track essentially how that land cover change and activity change results in a change in one of those four response variables. So again, just to kind of summarize, then our outputs for this study are going to be information on implementation, hopefully estimates of ecological response or non-response if the CAO is working, and ultimately recommendations for change via the GMA review or some long-term process. Some of the outcomes. Now, we say outputs and outcomes. This is lingo that the federal government, particularly our partner in this project, the EPA, uses. So outputs are essentially like products that we get, actual information. Outcomes are changes in behavior of the system or new knowledge that may or may not necessarily make immediate change. But ultimately out of this, we hope to actually establish a natural experiment-based approach to assessing land use regulations, get locally derived empirical measures, have a model framework for assessing regulations elsewhere. King County has an aggressive program of performance indicators. We call it KingStat, and you can check that out. We hope to be monitoring, using this for the KingStat, and ultimately developing partnerships and training opportunities with the University of Washington, the USGS, and the VCC is the Veterans Conservation Corps. Just a little bit about these partnerships and training opportunities. We're going to be working with Marina Alberti's group of the Urban Ecology Lab, bringing on a graduate student to look at sub-watershed scale variability in some of these parameters. So we learn more. We're not just like looking at the watershed as a black box, but we'll actually, hopefully through this person, really get into the details of how people develop their land and how that actually plays out in terms of an effect. We're working with a fellow who's sitting here in the audience, Christian Torgerson, with the USGS. One of his charges is to come up with an integrated landscape approach to monitoring for all of Puget Sound. Studies like this help somebody like him build a framework for how you would do that at a larger scale. You learn about natural variability. You learn about the scales of measurement, both time and space scales. You learn about the vagaries of what really goes on in terms of people's behavior that drive the change. So that's some of the partnerships and things. So applications, I kind of already described a little bit about King County's. Other local governments, what I see is mostly the development of the monitoring that's going on in other governments is mostly monitoring just for change. But if you don't monitor in a certain way, you might detect change, but you can't necessarily know whether or not that change is driven by your actions. So we're hoping that this will be something that will be more specific that other governments could apply. Salmon recovery, I don't need to probably tell hardly anyone in the group that that's an important thing in Puget Sound and throughout the Pacific Northwest. And understanding the effectiveness of land use regulations is an extremely high priority for that. And similarly, the Puget Sound Partnership, which is the recently formed organization to essentially try to recover and improve Puget Sound. Again, understanding regulations, how they work, their effectiveness is a high priority. Just a few of the next steps that we have. We're going to finalize a work plan, construct our database. We're going to have a four-year initial fieldwork program, and we're going to be starting these partnerships and collaborations work. I want to make sure I acknowledge some of the people who and some of the organizations that have been important in this. The U.S. EPA Region 10 has provided a significant amount of funding to help support this project for the next 4 years. It was part of their targeted watershed research grants. The University of Washington's Urban Ecology Lab will serve as an advisor and also helping to provide grad students. We have the U.S. Geological Survey, who will be providing valuable oversight and assistance. The Veterans Conservation Corps, these are folks returning back from war and basically trying to get integrated back into normal civilian life. And then King County, I want to make one special comment about King County. I think I and my colleagues feel very lucky that we work for an organization that allows us to do this. You may not be aware of it at your stage of life, but when you get into a big bureaucracy, it's rare that they tell you to go out and see if we're doing it right. I mean, that doesn't happen very often. So we're fortunate that they're doing it, and they're also putting a lot of King County's resources in this as well. So I personally, I think our team is very appreciative of that. There you go. Yeah, Heather.
How much?
It looks to be about a $2 million project. We're going to get about $625,000 from the EPA, and we're going to get some support, in-kind support from the VCC, a little bit from the USGS. So about that much. Yes?
Yeah, we're going to be talking about the $30 to $35 million annually to move the levees and the Veterans Pact.
Yes.
What's the name of that program, and what land is that on? Is that private land, on public land?
We have a plan called our Flood Hazard Reduction Plan. Guys, help me if you remember the name of it off the top of your head. I've got some other King County colleagues here. But if you were to Google up King County Flood Hazard Reduction Plan or Flood Plan, it would pop right up, actually, I suspect. That applies to anywhere that King County manages its flood control facilities. So it's not just the unincorporated part of the county. It also goes into urban growth areas as well. But mostly along the large rivers, so the Snoqualmie, the Cedar, the Sammamish, the Green, the White, and the South Fork of the Skye, and some of the larger streams like Issaquah Creek, Lower Bear Creek.
So it's King County managed land, it's not private.
No, look at the current private land. If we get in these situations where we'll have a flood control facility that exists on somebody's private property. We have easements for that, and so some of this work could occur on private land. Now, to the extent that it takes private land up, we have to compensate them. But it could occur on private land. I don't remember the exact details. A lot of it is retrofitting existing facilities, so we usually already have agreements or own the land or have the easement for the land. So it's not like we're going out buying new land to do more new flood control. It's mostly modifying existing facilities to make them less expensive to maintain, better functioning, and better habitat. Although the main goal isn't habitat, but we anticipate seeing a lot of habitat benefits. Yes? Yeah, and there's a lot more that would like to happen. Are you talking about the Carlin property?
I think so.
About a couple, 4 or 5 miles up the river?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great project. That was a classic thing where there was an old berm that had been built and constricted the Raging, which is a very dynamic river. We took that out, added vegetation, woody debris, and it's the last I saw, it's working fantastically, I think. It's very exciting. I've been with the county now for almost 20 years, and we've gone from the highly artificial, kind of engineer-dominated approach to a much more integrated approach,
Is it perfect?
No. But our approach more and more is looking at how do we restore process. I didn't go into the details about that, but part of our best available science conclusion is you really have to take a big step back and try to manage for the process. You can't achieve that everywhere, but where you can, that's what we're trying to achieve for a better river dynamic process and watershed process.
Thank you.